You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Get started on your painting project this summer and save big money at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust 5-in-1 Spray Paint lets you choose from 5 unique spray patterns with a twist of the dial, so you can get a professional, corrosion-resistant finish on every project. Save big money on Rust-Oleum Spray Paint now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Children have a right to life, a right to their mother and father, a right to innocence, a right to an intact, unmedicalized body. Their rights are being victimized. Screw your social acceptance. Start defending kids.
Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin, because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense. Hey, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Mercedes. I'm here with my friend Rachel, and we're here with our special friend, Katie Faust. Welcome, Katie.
No, I am happy to. It's my honor to be here with you. I love hanging out with my virtual friends, and I better make a whole lot of new ones after this.
You will. Exactly. That is the plan. But why don't you go ahead, Rachel, and introduce our friend to our listeners?
All right. I would love to. Katie Faust is founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement defending children's natural and inherent rights to their mother and father. She publishes, speaks, and testifies widely on why marriage and family are matters of justice for children. Her articles have appeared in Newsweek, USA Today, The Federalist, Public Discourse, World Magazine, The Daily Signal, The Washington Examiner, The American Mind. And the American Conservative, and I guarantee there's more. She's on the advisory board for the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. Katie has helped design the teen edition of Canavox, which I actually haven't. I want to hear more about that, which studies sex, marriage, and relationships from a natural law perspective. She detailed her philosophy of worldview transmission in her book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City. Her third book, Pro-Child Politics, was published September 24th. 24, excuse me. She and her husband are raising their 4 children in Seattle. And I will say
Seattle.
Did I say it wrong?
No, I'm having an exclamation. Yeah. As in yes. Like, yeah. Oh, like, you're in Seattle.
That needs to be noted. Yes. I want to say she wrote a first book that is the original reason I know about Katie, Them Before Us. If you have been around here longer than 3 or 4 years, you remember you might have been in that book club. And we read that and had Katie on as a guest. It was a pleasure, and it's a pleasure today. So hello, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me and the great introduction. Yes, I live in Seattle. I am one of 7 Christians that are still here.
All 7.
And a lonely existence. But it's fruitful, you know, like there's actually really good things happening in the Christian world and kind of in the conservative world, if we could ever get a fair voting system going on. We were the only state that moved slightly to the left in the last election.
And which I'm like, wild.
That which is wild. Everything went slightly right or massively right. Yeah. So I'm like, there's something going on under the covers that we are not allowed to.
Are you from Seattle? Like, is that why you're, I mean.
I'm from Portland, Oregon, which is the exact same thing. But I like, they have a little more homelessness. We have a few more like freeway blockages by protesters, and you just gotta trade.
Well, it's all dirt. Those 2 states are so gorgeous. I had family in Washington State, and I would visit, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm from Southern California. So I'd never seen so much green in all my life.
Just I know. My husband's from Colorado. He's like, Colorado's so pretty. And I'm like, I guess if you have not ever been to the Northwest, it's pretty. Yeah. I'm like, if you're right in the mountains, it's pretty. But half that state is just dirt with a sprinkler system.
Well, I'm curious because we heard a little bit about your professional career. I want to get more into your personal life later, but I want to know what led you to become such a passionate advocate for children's rights. Was there a particular moment or experience that crystallized this mission for you?
Yeah. I just got really, really, really angry.
Like, that'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do it. I think everybody gets, not everybody, a lot of people have gotten radicalized by the massive leftist overreach. You can be like, well, it was education. Oh, well, it was the COVID response, or it's abortion, or it's the transit, you know, kids playing in my daughter's, you know, field hockey team, or the man in my locker room, or like all of us have had something where we're like, that's it.
Yeah.
Get out. And so like, I think there's probably a lot of people in your audience 10 or 15 years ago, they probably were like, well, I wasn't that connected to politics. I wasn't very interested. I was just like, stay at home mom. That was me. I was like, stay at home mom. My husband was a pastor. We had just gotten home with our youngest child that we adopted from China. I've got three biological kids, one adopted child. And I was like, I am exhausted. I am busy. I was super engaged at my church. Like, I was focused on, you know, the needs of little kids. And I was like, politics, I just want to love people. I want to share the gospel. You know, like that's kind of where it was. And then it was marriage. Like marriage was the thing that radicalized me, because especially after President Obama evolved on the topic of marriage, I felt like all the guns were out in mainstream media to call anybody that disagreed with the gay marriage platform haters, bigots, homophobes. And and then they were normalizing motherless and fatherless homes. So those were the two things that I tried to have some reasonable conversations with my Facebook friends, which I was really engaged in Facebook at the time. Like, hey, you guys, I just want to let you know, like, I am a Christian, but I love my gay family. I mean, all of us, you know, back then, I love my gay family and friends. I'm not a homophobe. I'm not a bigot. I have gay friends. And I mean, most of my friends that knew me knew that I don't just have gay friends. My mother's in a lesbian relationship. They've been together for 40 years. So I'm like, no, I've been living with lesbians since before you were born, blue-haired activist screamer. So like, I just was like, no, I legitimately love gay people, like demonstrably, like put me in a courtroom and I'll show you. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter how much you love gay people. You are a bigot if you disagree. But my big, big objection was this normalization of motherless and fatherless homes in the name of civil rights and progress. So I just started talking about, gosh, you know, kids really need moms and dads. And marriage is typically the delivery system that we've used to give it to them. And so I started anonymous blogging about it. And very quickly realized that if kids need mom and dads, it's not just marriage that we have to be fighting for. We need to combat widespread casual divorce. We need to critique modern families of a variety of different persuasions. We need to hammer the third party reproductive marketplace that's taking place in the name of helping infertile couples. We need to condemn surrogacy in all cases. We need to have a proper understanding of adoption, that it's not a way to solve infertility, and it's not a way for gay people to have kids. It's a matter of justice for children. So I just kind of went into this world of like, oh my gosh, on all these different topics, children are being forsaken and adult desire is ruling the day. And then the kids just have to live with it. So I like looked at the world, the kind of political cultural landscape. And I was like, there's all these incredible organizations fighting for children's right to life, combating abortion. There's nobody fighting for children's rights in the family. And they do have fundamental concrete rights to be known and loved by the two people responsible for their existence. You defend that right, you solve pretty much every problem we're facing in society today.
So was it for you, do you look back yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before? I believe it was yesterday. You know, it's all over social media and the news headlines. 10 years has passed since Obergefell. Was that kind of the turning moment for you where you're like, I'm going all in? Like, I can't be quiet about this.
Yeah, I went all in terms of anonymous blogging in 2012. And then I was outed by a gay blogger in 2014.
I remember you saying that.
He like doxed my church and I'm like, oh, it's like so ugly. And then Obergefell came down in 2015. And I didn't start my nonprofit until 2018. So at the time, though, where I felt the fire and the like, I'm never going back, was 2012, even before Washington State had legalized gay marriage. It was right before that. But it was still this like, how dare you, how dare you weaponize one of the greatest wounds of childhood, losing their mother or father or both, and say, this is good and necessary for adult equality. It was just bazookas were out and they've never been put away since then.
So let me ask you a question on Obergefell specifically, because everybody talks and presents that case as, you know, it was gay rights for marriage. But you're coming from an angle about defending the rights of children. Like, why was it that? Because, you know, there were sellings like, we just want the same rights as everybody else. We want to be able to be married. We want, you know, if there's legal challenges, I want to be able to have a say in what happens with my spouse. So was there anything in particular about the ruling or the law itself? Or was it because, like, you gamed out the repercussions of that ruling and you saw it? Because, you know, people are going to accuse, and I'm sure you have been accused, that this is more, you're cloaking your defense of children when it's really what's rooted is your real motive is your intolerance towards gay people and their rights to just, like, live their life as they want to live it. So what was it about that ruling specifically? Was it something specific about the ruling itself, or was it because you kind of saw the repercussions of it, you know, for the future?
Yeah. Not just me, but many others. I submitted an amicus brief to the SCOTUS decision on Obergefell. I co-authored it with another woman, a woman who genuinely had been raised by two moms. I still had my mom and dad even after the divorce. And so we submitted an amicus brief saying, if you redefine marriage, you're going to redefine parenthood and children will lose their mother or father. Here's 35 stories of kids who grew up with same-sex parents or an LGBT parent who talk about how they suffered with identity issues, with mother or father hunger, suffering in terms of their development, longing to know their missing parent. So this is it. If you redefine marriage, you're going to redefine parenthood. And now we've been in it for 10 years. And you know what happened? We redefined marriage and then we redefined parenthood. We are seeing a cascade of different laws throughout the states that have created new definitions of parenthood so that unrelated adults can acquire children without any kind of screening or background check and take these infants home, sometimes to be abused, because that's what happens when you give unrelated adults access to babies without any kind of social worker involvement. We've seen mother and father stripped from parenthood laws all across the state. We've seen the push for commercial surrogacy in the name of LGBTQ equality. We see the redefinition of infertility taking place so that states or insurance companies are required to fund the creation of motherless or fatherless children for single or same-sex couples or throuples. And so what we said has absolutely happened. And it's not like we are like, I wonder what's going to take place. We are the 18th country to legalize same-sex marriage. In the other 17, zero of those states upheld or reinforced children's rights to their mother and father after the decision. A child's claim to their own mom and dad, the recognition that they should be raised by their mother and father, is totally incompatible with gay marriage. The two cannot coexist. You have to choose one or the other. Either children have a right to their mother and father, or gays need marriage to be equal. Pick. And so the truth is that children have a right to their mother and father, and gays don't have a right to marriage if it means overhauling the entire constellation of the marriage and family solar system when it comes to laws. So this is not a settled deal. I actually just got off the phone this morning with a coalition of legal minds where we are going to create a pathway to challenge Obergefell, or at least significantly limit it to saying you can have a license, but you don't get kids, because that is a fundamental injustice to children. You literally transform them from subjects of rights to objects of rights. It's no longer about who children are and what they have a right to. It's I have a right to kids. Give them to me no matter the cost.
So, okay. That is such a compelling argument. And I think that sometimes people who don't deal with this issue closely, they don't have family that is homosexual, or they don't have any experience with people who have adopted children in that way or gone down the surrogacy route. Sometimes they can not understand the implications of it in a real life way. And I know you mentioned, and I don't know if people ask you this very often, but I would be really curious from your own personal experience, what did it feel like and how has that kind of colored and brought more life into this advocacy for you being raised by two lesbians of whom you have a great relationship with them. But what did that do personally to you? What was your experience? Yeah.
So it's like, I don't talk a whole lot about my relationship with my mom and her partner because it's not a driving force for what I'm doing. Okay. Like I was not starved of my father's love. Like I was very close to him before the divorce and thankfully still very connected to him after. So I actually am like, I don't have the right story for this. I'm not a fatherless girl. I'm like, mm-hmm. I was really close to my dad and my mom. They had a really amicable relationship. I will tell you what it did for me personally is I'm really comfortable with gays and lesbians. I'm like, I meet somebody and it's like, I love you even before you share your pronouns with me. Like, like you're my people. And that's actually why it was really hard for me to get into this fight because I'm like, I love the gays. I love the gays. Give me all the gays. I just am. That was kind of my upbringing. So that to me is the thing that my childhood gives me that has been helpful in this conversation, where especially if I go speak to church groups, especially early on, I'd say, you cannot give one inch on the topic of marriage. You cannot compromise. Mm-hmm. You cannot stumble on this. You need to go full-throated male, female, permanent marriage for life, because any alternative means you're going to let kids suffer so you can keep your friends. But my message to them also was, and you should be the most loving, sacrificial, and joyous friend in the life of your LGBT community. Like if you've got a family member, if you have a friend, a niece, a nephew, a neighbor, they should think, when they think about you, they should think that girl is totally wrong about politics. But damn, she loves me better than everyone else. That is what people should think. And it is the confident, what do I know from my own life? That you can do both 100%. That you should not compromise at all on the definition of marriage because it's a matter of justice for children. And you should not shrink back from your friendships or relationships with people that identify as LGBTQ. And you can do both with all your might. It's hard. It's messy. But if you're biblical, you don't get to choose one or the other.
So when you're talking about rights, because you use the term rights a few times, especially when you're talking about children's rights. Now, a lot of times, you know, we're in a world where, especially now, where it's we prioritize the person that's already before us. And we especially see that in abortion. It's like, well, especially on the left, the most progressive, they're like, this embryo or this, you know, clump of cells, using their language, doesn't really matter to us because they're not a real human being before us. And so you can kind of make that argument too when you're advocating for the rights of a child, because, you know, you're also saying that you're presenting an argument where people do not have a right to a child. They don't have a right to be a parent. But a lot of people who will take it personally, especially anyone who struggles with infertility or hasn't had a family. I myself am childless. I haven't been able to have a family. I decided for my own moral reasons, much of which we're discussing here, not to pursue those avenues because of the moral implications of it. But a lot of people feel like they are being attacked or judged, or their rights are being impeded as to whether or not they can have the family that they dream of. Like, what is your, you know, how do you speak to those people? And what is it that you're defining as a right?
We spend quite a bit of time, I say we, because I co-authored my first two books with Stacey Manning, who is an absolute wordsmith queen. And she and I kind of developed something that we call the three rules that make it a rights test, because it is really important to understand what we mean by rights. Interestingly, anything, especially in the political space, that an adult really, 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 really wants is conveniently framed as a right. A right to government-funded birth control, a right to housing, a right to choose, a right to marry, a right to parenthood. Like, when you look at how do you know what a right is? And I think that's a really important question. We answer it, you know, Robert George, who is at one point was called like the most influential Christian in the country, like wrote the foreword for our first book. And when he agreed to do the foreword, he sent me a picture of him having dinner with Clarence Thomas. I mean, like, this guy knows what he's talking about. He is probably one of the top living academics on the topic of natural rights. So if you really want to deep dive into natural rights, you can go read Robert George. But if you want a working definition that is much more accessible, I'll give you our three rules that make it a rights test. So here's how you know whether or not something is a genuine natural right. And it's natural rights that I think we need to respect here, because you can call something a right. You can even have civil rights that don't align with natural rights. And it's the natural rights that are going to lead to just laws. So what makes a natural right? Three different criteria. Number one, a natural right exists pre-government. If the government, if you don't have it until the government gives it to you, it's not a natural right. Number two, nobody has to provide it for you. So if it has to be dug up from the ground, filtered, bottled, shipped, stored,
free,
labeled.
Like free healthcare would be a good example.
Right. For that. That's a commodity, right?
Yeah.
So it's housing. Like if you have to pour a foundation, sheetrock it, put a roof on it, plumbing, electric, that's a commodity. Commodities are very, very important, but you don't have a natural right to housing and you don't have a natural right to, you know, healthcare. So the third thing that I think is very clarifying is a natural right is something that everybody has in equal measure. So if it can vary in its distribution, like a GED versus a PhD or a dorm room versus Mar-a-Lago, it's not a natural right. So you can look at things like your right to life. How many do you have, Mercedes? How many, how many lives do you have, Mercedes? Got any life over there?
Yeah. One.
You've got one.
Just one. Just
yeah,
just
Rachel one. Also has one. Mm-hmm. I also only have one. That's how we know that your life, you do have your right to life. So Mercedes, how many parents do you have?
I mean, I have two for right now.
Yeah.
Same.
You,
everybody. I will always have two. Well, and I'll always have two. It doesn't matter. It's what I'm born with. It's what requires to exist in order for me to exist. Yep.
That's exactly right. So you can look at a right to life and see, yes, we do have a right to life. You can look at a child's right to the two people responsible for their existence. And you can say that also is a natural right. And then you compare in a few other limited rights, a right to defend yourself exists pre-government. Everyone has the same amount. Nobody has provided to you a right to free speech. Everyone has the same amount. It exists at pre-government. Nobody has provided to you. I mean, you can do that. That kind of, you can apply that grid to figure out what is and is not a natural right. So in light of that, we see that there's a lot of things that adults want that are not natural rights. So you don't have a right to parenthood. If that means that some child has to lose their right, their genuine right to life, or their right to their own mother and father. You, if you have a baby, you 100% have a right to that baby. But you don't have a right to just any baby in the hospital. You have a right to the one baby that came from your body. That is a pre-political natural law, doesn't vary in terms of its degree. Nobody has to provide it for you kind of relationship. So when you properly define rights, you see that what a lot of people want to pass off as rights are not rights. They're desires, they're commodities, but they're not rights.
You know, as a homeschool mom with four girls, finding news content that's actually appropriate for kids feels almost impossible these days. Everything's either dumbed down to the point of being useless, or it's filled with stuff I have to pre-screen because, heaven forbid, we get actual facts without a woke agenda attached. That's why I love Worldwatch. It's a daily news video designed specifically for kids that doesn't make me nervous about what they're going to hear. My girls actually get excited when it's time for our 10 minutes of World Watch because it covers real stories, the big, important stuff, and the fun, lighter things, all with a biblical worldview that aligns with our family's values. And can we talk about how refreshing it is to have news that recognizes God's design and everything? Plus, with a paid subscription, you get access to their full archive. So if we want to revisit a story or catch up on something we missed, it's all right there. World Watch delivers fact-based video news you can feel good about. As a busy homeschool mom, that's exactly what I need. Daily videos that help my kids explore the world while keeping our faith at the center. Check out the link in our show notes to get 3 free months. Trust me, it's an easy win for any parent who's tired of having to watch everything ahead of time, just to make sure it's safe for their kids.
So the big difference that you're pointing out there is that because people will be like, well, you know, a two-parent household, it's all about being in a two-parent household. So swapping out whether it's two men or two women or two, you know, a straight couple or regardless. Or I don't know, maybe you even have a mom and a second, another generation living in the home. You know, families are structured in all sorts. But in order for that person who isn't, I guess, biologically tied to you, it would require the state in some way to designate that you're a parent over that child. So then
there's some level of state construction that needs to be involved whenever you're going to deviate from the biological mother and father being married to each other. And interestingly, because the data is so obvious, even scholars on the left, Melissa Kearney wrote a book called The Two-Parent Privilege. You know, even scholars on the left are like, look, single motherhood really is not the same. But the truth is that kids don't just need a two-parent home. That is a coward's way of talking about the family, because any two will not do. A child who is being raised by their mother and her new husband fare about as well as children who are being raised by a lone mother, which is to say, not as well. There is only a privilege when it is the child's own mother and father married to each other for life. So we have an entire chapter in our first book, Them Before Us, on why biology matters in the parent-child relationship. And I'll just give you the quick rundown. It matters because biological parents grant children something that they crave, which is their biological identity. It's very hard for kids to answer the question, who am I, if they can't answer the question, whose am I? And this is why we have had a major overhaul in the world of adoption in this country. It used to be all closed adoptions. Now 95% of adoptions are open adoptions because kids need to answer the question, who am I? Number two, a child's biological mother and father are statistically,
People can't see that you had balloons. Just remember, we're just audio. She's like, why is she singing? She just had balloons show up on her screen.
Right. Because when I put number two up, I think that my Zoom call thinks I'm saying victory. I have no idea. But a child's own biological mother and father are statistically the safest, most connected to, most invested in, and protective of kids. So when you're seeing the privilege, it's not any two, it's that biological investment that whether you're looking at it from a biblical kind of fallen nature side of things or an evolutionary perspective, adults are investing in their own genetic offspring more than another kind of child. And then the third reason why is if you're defending a child's claim right to their own biological parents, you always get the perfect gender balance in the home 100% of the time. And kids need mothers and kids need fathers, and they do different things developmentally, and kids suffer without one or both. So there's no argument to be made really that any other kind of pairing or throupling is going to be able to equate to
the benefit. I'm just laughing
at
the fact that that's like a term that we have to even-
A thing.
It's a thing.
Yeah. Okay. So in light of that, how do we go about understanding, you just talked about the rights to the parents, but do you go in your literature even beyond that? Like what, when we say we're going to put children's rights before adult desires, is that only, do you only discuss that in terms of just the parental relationship, or do you zoom out and look at it even more?
Oh, are there I have other opinions. Rights? Do you want to know?
I have thoughts.
Yeah. Give me a few.
I think my pinned tweet is still, children have a right to life, a right to their mother and father, a right to innocence, a right to an intact, unmedicalized body. Their rights are being victimized. Screw your social acceptance, start defending kids. I think that that's like my pinned tweet. And the idea is like actually every major cultural issue that we're battling today in media and sometimes in the courts do come down to children's fundamental rights. Now it's too bad that we have to have a understanding that children have a right to innocence and they shouldn't necessarily have porn that is like violent and predatory channeled straight into their pocket with no kind of digital barriers at the age of 7. And it's too bad.
You mentioned that. And we just wrapped watching SCOTUS, the Supreme Court hand down multiple rulings today, ruling in favor of the rights of children. And I think it should be noted that the three dissenting judges on all these cases are three females who, with two out of the three, have no children. They have no skin in the game. And they continually place the rights of adults over the rights of children. And it couldn't be more clear. Speaking of pornography, that was Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton today, where all they wanted to do was put age verification laws on porn sites. And these three women said that violated free speech. I mean, this is a whole other conversation. Obviously, porn isn't free speech, but that even if they believed it to be free speech, the rights of adults to do lewd, lascivious, and evil things trumps children's innocence.
Yeah.
And we saw it in Mahmoud v. Taylor with sexually explicit materials being forced on kids. And so it really isn't just about the marriage and the coupling of a man and a woman giving birth and raising the child and the child having a right to that. But it is more. There's more rights that are being infringed on.
Every way that a child can be victimized, they're being victimized. The only place where that's not happening right now is if they're being raised in a home where parents genuinely understand their duty to children. Because otherwise, you know, like we submitted an amicus brief in that Paxton case. Mm-hmm. And I have an article coming out on it later today. And yes, this absolutely was a pitting of a non-adult right, which is safeguarding their innocence. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with the sexual content in supposed, you know, sex ed curriculum.
Right.
But like children actually have a right to not be scandalized and harmed through adult content. And that is literally why we've had ratings on movies forever. And so again, very important to properly define rights. Your right to watch gangbang or step porn or hentai porn is not an actual right. Children have a right to innocence and laws. Here's another thing that is going to be relevant for all these conversations, definitely in marriage and family, definitely in abortion, also in porn, is I have learned over 10 years of mouthing off that whoever is the victim determines the policy. Mm-hmm. So we, as people on the right, must always make sure we are properly identifying the victim. Stunner, it's children in 100% of cases. So we need to take the focus off of adults who, like, they might have to do some kind of age verification by showing a picture of their hand to some kind of AI machine they're not showing their identity. They're not giving their driver's license. There's all kinds of technology to verify, hey, you're not an 11-year-old, but that's too inconvenient for you, right? Instead, we need to have, you know, an 8-year-old sucked into this world of pornography and get addicted so they're a non-functioning member of society. And every romantic relationship they enter in after that is going to involve some kind of choking. So it's like we have got to get very serious about properly identifying the victim, whether it is the transgender debate or the sex ed curriculum debate or the abortion debate or the IVF debate or the surrogacy debate or the marriage debate. Yep. In 100% of all of these cases, when we get them wrong, children suffer.
Yes.
So our job as conservatives, as just responsible adults, but 100% as Christians, is to come to the defense of children, even if that means you might not be invited to Thanksgiving next year. Kids are worth it.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Specifically with surrogacy, I'm very interested in what you have to say, because you can make this is the scenario. The scenario is like, for some reason, I'm unable to carry, or maybe I don't want to carry. That is a thing right now.
That's happening a lot.
That's like,
I got this bikini body.
I don't want to carry. So, yeah, but I'm going to take my genetic material, my husband's genetic material. I'm going to rent this woman's womb for, you know, 9 to 10 months. She's doing it willingly. I'm paying her. We're all in agreement. And then at the end of the day, I'm going to take this child home, and she or he is going to be with their genetic parents. So they have right there, they have a right to their genetic mother and father, and they're going to be in a two-parent household with a mother and father. Like, what is does that affect your argument with rights? Like, how do you discuss that situation?
It's wrong. But I'll tell you
why. I have a lot of opinions about why it's wrong, especially when it comes to just the commodity of it, the moral implications of it. Also, I play around with this idea of like people saying like, well, I have a right. So like, I mean, you could end up with some weird social credit system of like women renting out their wombs to like benefit from society because you've sacrificed yourself so somebody else can have a right. Like, there's a lot of dystopian things that can evolve into.
Oh, and it's evolving. Like, it gets worse than where we are right now. I mean, we've got artificial wombs on the horizon. We've got robot nannies being developed. We've got technology in process to create gametes from like skin cells or saliva or hair follicles. I mean, like, we are getting into Gattaca territory, beyond Gattaca. It's bad. But let me even steel man your case even further. Like, let's say that there's no money that's being paid. Let's say that it's a woman's sister who's doing it for free because she had her uterus removed and the child's going home with both genetic parents. And there's no children that are being destroyed in the process, which never happens with surrogacy. IVF, in IVF, which almost all surrogacy babies are products of IVF as well. Only about 3% of IVF babies are ever born alive. 97% are going to be frozen forever, donated to research, screened out of existence, genetically selected into oblivion. So unfortunately, you've got a lot of loss of life even before you get to the surrogacy question. But let's say that they didn't do any of that. Let's say that they're the, you know, 5% or less mm-hmm. who actually said, we're going to only create embryos that we intend to immediately implant. No one's going to get frozen. Nobody's going to get any kind of screening or grading that's going to affect who we implant. So what's the problem?
It's not their mom.
Yeah, the problem is that woman who's not genetically related, who might not be paid any money at all,
will now be DNA and genetically related with them for life. They're woven together in their DNA.
That's part of it, right? That you have this microchimerism that takes place mm-hmm. where mom and baby swap genetic information. And that mm-hmm. surrogate is going to have the cells of that child to be discoverable in her brain 10 years after. But even beyond that, from the baby's perspective, when mm-hmm. that baby is born, the only person, the only thing the baby mm-hmm. knows is that woman. That surrogate is the only thing the baby knows. Even if that baby gets handed off to their genetic mother or father, those two adults are strangers among 8 billion. Mm-hmm. And we know that children, neonates, struggle when they are separated from their birth mother. They have higher levels of cortisol that are released. They are not soothed by other adults. I mean, you know, you look at these pictures of men who are like, oh, look, we're doing skin-to-skin contact with this child that we just purchased. No. Like, kids don't just need skin-to-skin contact with anybody. They need skin-to-skin contact with the thing that they know. It is her voice, her smell, her milk, her body, her heartbeat. That is the only thing. And like, Rachel, like, I'm curious, when you had your baby, mm-hmm. I imagine she?
All girls.
Yeah. Okay. So was she crying?
Yeah. Until they put her on my chest. And then it
was. Yeah. And then what happened?
And then she stayed there for the next. I fed her and she fell asleep and stayed in my arms for the next couple weeks. She was regulated. Her heartbeat went down. And I will say, alternatively, our second baby was in distress and I didn't even get to hold her for, I want to say, almost 24 hours. She was sent to the, I could still cry thinking about it. She was sent to the NICU and she's fine. She's 14. She's perfect. There's no, like, you know, issues that we need to talk about, but it was distressing. And we never really know what that does to a child. It's distressing for her. No one, she would just lay there and cry. And then I would get to come in and she would stop immediately, even if she had been held by another nurse or even sometimes Sean. It was only her mother. I don't know. It's natural.
We do not place babies on the chest of their mothers after mm-hmm. birth so they can form a bond. We place babies on the chest of their mothers because they have an existing bond, a bond mm-hmm. that takes 9 months to develop. And we know that children who are adopted at birth struggle disproportionately mm-hmm. with academic challenges and higher elevated rates of externalizing disorders, even though those adopted children are largely being raised by adults who are wealthier, better educated, and have more stable marriages. There is something that we have not been able to compensate for when it comes to what adoptees often call a primal wound. Mm-hmm. They were wounded on the moment that they were, the day they were born, because mm-hmm. they lost the only thing that they knew and they had to start from scratch, building a bond with people that they did not know. Yeah. So this idea that you can just cut the child off from that one relationship, it's not even a relationship, it's their entire world. There's mm-hmm. no world outside of that woman. That you can obviously see it in the cortisol levels dropping when the baby has contact with that woman, but then you can see it long-term in adoptees through their additional struggles. So there is no situation where surrogacy does not force children to lose something they need and have a right to. And unlike adoption, which is sometimes necessary in this broken world, Surrogacy may be very wanted, but it's never necessary. It's always some adult saying, you are going to lose something that you need and have a right to because I want something.
Can I ask
if you have more questions about surrogacy, probably the place where I make it the cleanest and answer most of the objections is an article I wrote at the Federalist about a year ago called The Conservative Pro-Life Case Against Surrogacy. And it contrasts it with adoption. It talks about the risks to children's right to life. It talks about the three different mothers, genetic mother, birth mother, and social mother, that surrogacy splices and acts as if all three of those are optional when none of them are. So Conservative Pro-Life Case Against Surrogacy is the fastest way to, I think, become an expert on the issue and be able to speak confidently about it.
So you've mentioned a lot of times, like, you've made statements like we know or it's known, that sort of thing. And a lot of times you engage in these debates with people on opposition that'll be like, who is we? How do you know? Like, is this being studied? A lot of times, sometimes I know that there are issues that aren't studied because they're not politically viable. And we've seen that, especially in the last like decade or so. But, you know, is this, I just want you to like, if you were to get pushback, is like, is this your opinion? Or like, what do you mean we know? Who is we? Like, where is this coming from?
I did an interview last week in Australia with a gay journalist who is, I think he kind of introduced himself or someone's like, well, he's kind of like the Australian Dave Rubin. And I was like, okay, great. So he has two surrogate born babies and he's gay married, but you know, he's good on things like free speech and a little bit on Western civilization. And so he's like, well, this form of family that you're advocating for, I mean, like, how do you even know that it's right? And I'm like, oh yeah, how do we know that? Because we've done decades of study on family structure. And until about 2005, sociologists all agreed that married biological mother and father in a low conflict marriage benefited children. How else do we know? Common sense, which is like, well, I'm just looking at common sense. Well, common sense says that the two people that make the baby are probably best positioned to raise the baby. And then we know because beyond just, you know, those Christians, the five major religions of the world, despite disagreeing about the nature of God, the problem in the world, the solution to the problem, the nature of the afterlife, they all agree that it would be good for men and women to get married before they have sex and stay together forever. So you've got agreement on, you know, worldview levels. And then you just have natural law, right? Which we've already talked about, natural rights. Like, there's no natural right to segment a child's mother into three, purchase them by via contract, and permanently starve them of maternal love. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So it's like, who is we? Everything except the last 5 minutes of history and the technological workarounds that make it possible to create motherless and fatherless children.
Yeah. And this also kind of applies, again, going back to the Supreme Court cases today, in Mahmoud v. Taylor, it wasn't just Christian nationalists coming forward. It was literally like Muslim families, Catholic families, Christian families. You had Ethiopian Christians. You had Greek Orthodox families. They all, again, our timeline of what is considered natural rights, what is considered socially acceptable, what's considered beneficial for children is so short-sighted. We have very, very short memory spans, if you will. We think of everything in the last, you know, decade, when for all of time, showing kids the stuff that they are now privy to on a daily basis, either in the classroom or through their telephone, would have gotten people arrested. Like, you just, this is not appropriate. So it even goes beyond the discussion about, you know, a mother and a father figure in the household being your biological parents. This extends to all kinds of other rights if you're going to think about it holistically.
Yeah, it's what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery.
Yep.
Like, anybody that came before me, they didn't understand the world the way I did. I'm more enlightened. I'm
scientific.
Which
is chronic right now.
Yes, absolutely.
Very chronic. Yep. Yeah. All right. So what is the next step then? Because, and I've thought about this a lot, when we lived in California, on our street, there were multiple gay marriages where they had children. And so my kids got a, you know, entry into that reality really young, actually. And I've never stopped thinking about them because they were two nice women. They had children. So what if, you know, we had stayed? And what if I had shared the gospel with them? What if I had talked with them about the natural rights of children and they had gone, you know what, you're right. What would have been the next step? We already have kids in single parent households, step families, adoptive families.
Divorced families.
Yes. What
like third-party reproduction families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does children's rights first mean to those families that are already formed differently?
All right, friends, hold on to your pantalones because Rachel has some serious intel for all the parents out there who are tired of the media dumpster fire, but still want your kids to know what's happening in the world. Rachel's out here living the dream, raising lambs, homeschooling four girls, and actually has to deal with the "Mom, what's happening?" questions without traumatizing anyone after overhearing our enthusiastic podcast conversations. So Rachel, tell our listeners about this amazing video news opportunity that apparently is going to save their sanity.
Okay, so a lot of our listeners are familiar with World News, but have you guys heard of their student-focused video product, WorldWatch? It's daily news videos designed specifically for kids, but from a Christian worldview, like fact-based journalism that helps kids explore the world, learn news literacy, all while recognizing God's design in everything.
And you don't have to pre-screen it like content, you know, policing?
Exactly. 10 minutes, a video a day, no weird agenda, no scary stuff they're not ready for. Plus, with a paid subscription, you get access to their full archive if you want to catch up or revisit stories. Just real news videos you can actually feel good about letting them watch. And right now, you can get 3 free months. So check it out. Because unlike everything else in the media, you can trust this.
There you have it, friends. Rachel approved video news for your kids with 3 free months to try it. And we know Rachel has strong opinions. So if Rachel trusts it with her 4 girls, you know it's the real deal.
A lot of people will come to me and say, I divorced and I was like, oh, it's no big deal. 2 households, you know, more people to love them. And like 10 years later, you know, my 16-year-old is cutting herself. And I now realize that it's because I completely destroyed her world. Or, hey, you know what? I believed this whole thing that like I could just go get an egg donor and it would be no big deal. But now my child is like, who is my real mother? And now they stay up late at night on the internet, like on this obsessive hunt to try to find who their biological parent is. And I mean, I think that there's adults who I look back on and I'm like, well, goodness, with this one kid, I really messed up. Or with this other kid, I'm like, gosh, that was such a misstep or whatever. I think a lot of the parenting world is going, I didn't know what I was doing, or I ignored what I knew to be right. And I can see how it impacted my child. So I actually talked to a lot of parents, divorced, same-sex parents, people who are single parents for a variety of different reasons. And what I tell them is, your child has a wound. Your child has suffered loss. There was harm done. So now you need to figure out, are you going to allow that child to process in isolation, or are you going to enter into their processing with them so they're not alone? Because when you are dealing with when you are mourning something and you mourn in isolation, you are incredibly vulnerable to not just self-destructive behavior, but you're very vulnerable to being sucked into the world of people who might use your vulnerability for their own gain. And so I tell parents, you need to enter into that with them. They need to be able to tell you everything, and you need to own whatever part of that you can. You need to take responsibility without deflecting, without being defensive. You need to say, I am so sorry that your father and I did not work harder to keep our marriage together. At the time, I thought that, you know, it was just too much for me. At the time, I thought it would be better if we would just separate and we would be able to work things out and we would stop fighting. But you know what? It turned out we just kept fighting. And now we're fighting in 2 different houses and you're getting less of me and less of your dad. And I was wrong. And I'm sorry because my choices affected you. And I want to let you know that you can tell me anything that you want about that. And I'll only speak if you say, what do you think, Mom? But other than that, I just want to hear everything. I would consider it such an honor if you just told me everything that you're thinking about this. Mm. That's how you move forward. And there may not be repair. You might not be able to say, let's go out and find your sperm donor father, and he's going to have been looking for you all his life and want to welcome you into a relationship where he'll share all of his medical information, and his new wife and the children in his home aren't going to be threatened by your existence at all. You might not be able to say that. You can just say, I'm going to be in this with you. I recognize the harm I'm done, and you do not have to be alone in your loss and in your grief.
That's really compelling.
That's
I find that because there's an argument from left or progressives, especially when it's they're pro-abortion, and very nihilistic mindsets, frankly, where they're like, I didn't ask to be born, or they don't really exist, so we really shouldn't be concerned with them. But then also at the same time, there's they'll say, well, what, do you want them never to have existed? Like, they're already here. What if you take this right away from whatever form of family that we're talking about? But, you know, you're limiting some way, or you're limiting people from being able to have kids. And they're like, well, that could have been president. They could have, I don't know, cured cancer or whatever. Like, what would you say? Would you prefer that they just not exist? That they're, what would be your response to that question?
Yeah, well, Jordan Peterson asked me this on his podcast when we chatted a couple months ago, because, you know, by his choice, not mine, we spent 40 minutes talking about gay parenting and surrogacy and IVF. And, you know, at the end of talking about the importance of all three mothers in a child's life, and that men can never replace any one of those, and children need all of them, and the same sex parenting studies, and how it's all like methodological trash, and that all surrogacy is going to force children to sacrifice, even when they go home with the sweet Christian heterosexual couple. I mean, at the very end, he's like, but then what do you say about, well, you wouldn't exist without, would you rather be dead? And that is a question that pretty much every child of surrogacy or sperm or egg donation or IVF has to answer. And I actually think that it is the height of emotional manipulation, because it says, shut up about your grief. You are not allowed to feel the things or ask the things that every human child throughout history has asked. You don't get to be, you can't ask those existential questions at all. Where did I come from? Who is my mother and father? Like, and it's interesting because I just think that it's emotionally manipulative, because the truth is these kids should be able to say, who is my mother? That's not a question that donor-conceived children ask. It's a question that humans ask. Every human asks that question. You know, who is my father? What is my purpose? Why did I come to be? Kids should be able to ask that question. And just because we are critical of the circumstances of a child's conception does not mean that we invalidate their life. In fact, because we value their life, because we understand that they are precious and have dignity, that's the very reason why we critique the circumstances of their conception. This whole idea, well, they wouldn't exist without it. I'm like, fabulous. There's kids that wouldn't exist except for rape. We're going to green light that, endorse it, incentivize it, write it into California laws, which they kind of are doing anyway. Like, no, you can be critical of how some children come to be and still say your life is altogether wonderful and you are worthy of life, of dignity and protection. Mm-hmm. So I reject that. And I think that it's a very adult-centric way of looking, where the reality is.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question, because like when you're talking about, like when you were addressing the question of the family already existing, it takes a certain amount of emotional maturity on the on behalf of the parent to not take it personally that this child is asking you these questions, or why they're seeking out this, you know, biological parent or whatever the situation is. And sometimes there are moments where parents will be, I don't know, because they're hurt, they'll be like, well, I mean, would you prefer that I hadn't sought you out, or I didn't want to have a family, and then you weren't here with us, and I didn't provide you the life that, you know, you have. And that's why I think I'm presenting it, because, you know, a lot of people, we are emotional. I mean, most of us are emotional beings. And because of that, you know, I'd like to ask the question of, like, if someone's feeling like, well, what would you want me to do? Not have the kid? You know, like, what would, that's why I presented the question.
I want to say, like, I want to try and end on a real positive note. And I have a thought, and then I have a question for you. And I think this will serve, hopefully, as an encouragement to you, but also to the listeners. This is totally a personal anecdote, but I have been talking about surrogacy and IVF on my platform for quite a while, and why I'm against it, and why I believe that Christians need to speak out against it. I recently had an interaction with a gal who said, I've been following you for a long time. One of my children was born from IVF. And when you started talking about it at the beginning, I was really hurt. But I stayed and I kept listening. And now that I know more, I see it differently now. And it was because, you know, you throw these things out there on the internet, you type behind a screen, but you don't know who's reading them. And we do need to be forceful in our, not forceful, we need to be
bold, I think.
Bold in, that's right, bold in our opinions, but also compassionate that people will read them and they're not automatically going to just go, oh, you're right, I'll change my whole lifestyle now. But given time and prayerful consideration, the Lord can soften people's hearts. And so I want to encourage people that it's not a lost cause to talk about these things. And it can make a difference when we present people with the truth and just allow it to marinate and let the Lord work using us, but do his work through.
It's like me and mom jeans. I had to see it for like 3 years before I was like, maybe I could try that. And now all I wear is mom jeans. But like I when they first came out, I was like, that is the ugliest thing. I remember my mother wearing those in the 80s and thinking she's so frumpy. But like I had to see it for a long time. I had to see a lot of really cute girls wear it. I had to see a lot of fashionable moms wear it before I was like, maybe I can try this. Like, I know it's stupid, but like I didn't take to it the first time. And it's the same thing with reorienting your mind about marriage and family. The first time you hear it, children have a right to their mother and father. What are you talking about? But that means that my friends aren't going to be able to get a divorce, even though she just feels like she is so sick of the housework. And why can't he do more? And, or, oh my gosh, this means that my infertile friends aren't going to be able to have a baby. They would be such incredible parents. What are you talking about? That's so cruel. I understand. It takes a while. You've got to see the people walk around in the mom jeans. You've got to see the people talking about it from the perspective of the kids that were affected, the parents that go, I did IVF. I've got these two kids that I love, but I'm now 48 years old and I've got 8 kids in the freezer and I'm absolutely paralyzed. I don't know what to do. And you have to start hearing these arguments for a while before you go, yes, this is a seamless garment in terms of an understanding of marriage and family and parenthood that has traction. It's been communicated to me in beauty with reason. I've had honest answers to my honest questions. Yes. I am finally on board. So you're doing, you know, pioneering work. There's a lot of people that started, you know, Ali Beth Stuckey was talking about this before it was popular. Seth Gruber, I was on his show a couple times. Boy lost donors over me. And now they're back, you know, because it took a couple of years for them to be like, okay, I understand now that that if I'm really pro-life, I have to fight the baby taking industry of abortion and the baby making industry of IVF. But it takes a while. We have a lot of education to do on our side of the fence.
That's true.
So if you were to give some of our listeners a way, they want to follow your work, they want to be actionable, they want to educate themselves, advocate more, like what would be some tools that you would hand to them so they can go forth and help and advocate for the children who, frankly, I mean, the biggest thing is that, and I think that's what's hardest here, is that these kids don't have a voice. And that's the biggest challenge, is that the louder voices come from people that are really advocating for their own self-interest and not the interests of children, because children don't even know what their interests are.
I had this conversation with somebody at a major conservative, like one of the biggest conservative organizations. And I said, you guys need to go all in on children's rights, not just parental rights, because that doesn't protect all kids, not just religious liberty, because you're still going to throw some kids to the wolves. You need to go all in on children's rights, especially children's rights to their mother and father. And she said, the problem with your approach, Katie, is that at some point it's going to interrupt every adult's self-interest.
Correct.
That's correct.
Rich is like, yes,
that's right. And it's very much like, I believe I'm against abortion except 3 cases: rape, incest, and my case. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody wants to make an exception. Everyone, you know, not everyone. A lot of conservatives believe children have a right to life, that, you know, the nuclear family is the most traditional family is important, and kids need to be protected and innocence and transing and blah, 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 until we have to sacrifice for it. And then they go, well, maybe not really. But my message and my nonprofit is one of unflinching insistence that you are not going to get what you want at some point.
Correct? I am a mother of 4, and I'll tell you, I give up my rights a lot, okay? And that's just life. Like, you signed up for it when you became an adult and decided to procreate or create in a lab or whatever, however you obtained your children. It's always going to be them over us. It should always be them over us.
And I would say, said that's life, but I would say that to justice.
Yes.
It is justice when adults sacrifice for children. It is injustice when children sacrifice for adults. So I am advocating for a world of justice. That means that sometimes adults will not get what they want, but children will always get what they need. And what do we need to do? We need to become the child defending brigade. They can't defend themselves. We have to do it for them. We need to do it on, I would say, every major cultural issue, whether it's abortion or reproductive technologies or marriage or divorce or modern families or surrogacy or polygamy or, you know, all the different modern technologies that are still going to be coming at us. We need to adopt the posture of, oh, if you want to go for the kids, you have to come through me. So you're not going to be able to do that unless you know what you're talking about. So you need to become an expert. There's a lot of great accounts that you can follow online. We are on Instagram. Rachel obviously is doing good stuff. You need to know more about this than anyone else. You need to be able to speak up in a conversation at a coffee shop, and you need to be able to comment on terrible legislation in your state. You have to be the expert. We are really working hard to try to help people, especially on marriage and family issues and reproductive technologies, to do exactly that. So follow us on social media, Them Before Us. I have a lot of opinions on Twitter if you want beyond marriage and family. Go to thembeforeus.com and subscribe. We've got free church curriculum that you can do with your small group. No prep, no homework, just me video triggering everybody so you don't have to. So like I will make you the expert. If you have listened to this, you're like, damn straight, it is time for kids to have like proper representation. Then you're my people. Get over here and get in on this.
Yeah. Any other questions, Rachel, before I wrap us up for today's
episode? I love someone who's fiery and passionate about things that I am. Just makes me glad I'm on brand. One in the fight.
Yeah, we always joke around that in our podcast and stuff like that, that we don't have, we're not exactly gentle sometimes in our opinions or our thoughts. Because at some point, I know it's really hard for people when, especially when you're engaging with friends and family, that you don't want to cause waves. And it's not necessarily that you have to go out there and get in their face and confront them, but that we have information that when the question, the opportunity arises, that you're able to speak boldly about it and confidently. And that if they do push back on you, that you can justly and present your case. And hopefully, like Rachel said, you know, some people, they won't receive it immediately. But a lot of times it's about planting that seed and then eventually them coming around and realizing that maybe they need a little bit of a change of opinion, that it's not, that it's not a crazy idea to put children first over your own interest. Well, I want to thank you so much for hanging out with us and sharing your story and your vision and your goals with our listeners. Make sure you guys check out our show notes and follow her, click on it, subscribe. Do you have, so like on your, with your organization, is there any way that they can sign up and get regular updates from your organization about what you guys are doing and how they can participate?
Oh, we have updates. We have all the updates. Go to thembeforeus.com. There should be a box that pops up to like stay connected, subscribe. You should totally subscribe. We will equip you to the teeth to fight for kids.
Yeah. And make sure you also check out her book. So I'll have all those links in the show notes. That's it for today's episode of Rivera and Reeves. We are done. If this is your first time here, welcome. You found your new favorite podcast. So make sure you give us a 5-star rating, a lovely review, share it with a friend, and show Katie some love because she spent some time with us and we appreciate it. So that's it. That's all we have. And we'll see you for another episode of Rivera and Reeves next week. Okay. Bye.
Bye.